This is episode 54 of Beyond the Bulletin. Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Beyond the Bulletin. I'm Brandon Sweet, editor of the Daily Bulletin.
And for Media Relations, I'm Pamela Smythe.
We're coming to you from our homes where we're practicing physical distancing. Thank you for joining us as we go Beyond the Bulletin.
And like we've done every week, we'll talk about some of the top stories featured in the Daily Bulletin and then look ahead to see what's on the horizon, both inside and outside Ring Road.
Mostly outside Ring Road these days. We'll also take the opportunity to speak with Waterloo people and personalities about key issues that matter.
This week, we welcome back Victor Arora from the Gustav Backus Observatory on campus. It's closed now due to the pandemic, so Victor's going to come and give us tips on skywatching in your own backyard.
That sounds very cool. I will note that Victor's last name is one U away from like one of the perfect astronomer's names or astronomical names. Why? Did we make that joke last time?
No, but I just noticed it long time ago.
So here we are at episode 54.
54.
Studio 54.
Car 54.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you?
And well, I know where we are. Still stuck in our homes, regardless of whatever phase we're in.
I'm disappointed that I missed the opportunity to trick you into playing 52 pickup with me in episode 52.
Well, we'll have to strongly consider the numerological significance of our episode numbers going forward to ensure we don't miss these opportunities.
Yes.
But speaking of missing opportunities, here's what's been happening. We'll start off with a reminder this week that you must wear a face covering inside common areas of university buildings. If you have approval to return to campus or to enter any university buildings, you must wear something that covers your face.
So a face covering can be a medical or non-medical mask, a bandana, a scarf, or other covering that covers your nose, mouth, and chin.
Halloween is going to be very interesting this year, I think. So these guidelines apply to all common indoor spaces on our campus, including corridors, lobbies, washrooms, elevators, classrooms and lecture halls, teaching labs and meeting rooms, or in any area where physical distancing is a challenge. In employee-only areas, managers will set the expectation with their teams based on physical setup and work activities.
There are some rare exceptions for people who are unable to wear a mask. For more information and the latest guidelines, please visit the link in the show notes.
In other news, earlier this week, Provost Jim Rush circulated a memo to campus on copyright and fair dealing in the wake of a recent federal court of appeal decision that impacts the post-secondary education sector.
In April, the court released its decision in the case of York University versus the Canadian Copyright Licensing Agency, or Access Copyright. There were two main issues in this case. The first was whether the Copyright Board's post-secondary tariff is mandatory in its application to institutions. The second was whether confirming with York University's 2012 fair dealing guidelines constitutes fair dealing under the Copyright Act.
On the first issue, the court found in York University's favor and confirmed that the Copyright Board tariff was not mandatory and therefore not enforceable against York University. On the second issue, the court found in favor of Access Copyright and upheld the decision of the Federal Court of Canada. It found that York University's 2012 fair dealing guidelines would not necessarily constitute fair dealing under the Copyright Act.
Oh, this is very confusing. In light of this decision, the Vice President, Academic and Provost reminds the campus community that all students, faculty, and staff should continue to follow the University of Waterloo fair dealing guidelines.
The university has supports and resources available to help you navigate copyright issues, including the Fair Dealing Advisory Guidelines website, copyright guidance for online instruction on the university's Keep Learning website, and experts available to answer questions by sending them to copyright@uwaterloo.ca.
We'd also recommend reading a recent Daily Bulletin article covering this topic. It's part of the Ask an Online Learning Expert series entitled, What Do I Need to Know About Copyright When Teaching Online?
I have it on good authority that both York University and Access Copyright appealed the various rulings that went against them in that split decision.
Of course they did.
We'll put the links to these resources in our show notes for this episode on soundcloud.com. Camelia Nunez is moving on from her role as Director of Concept, Velocity's Experiential Entrepreneurship and Pre-Incubator Program. In a blog post on Concept's website, Nunez bids friends and founders farewell and reflects on her time leading the Concept program. Nunez has worked at Waterloo for over a decade, starting out as a casual lecturer in 2006. She also held the roles of Associate Director at Velocity, Corporate Research Partnerships Manager in the Office of Research, and Business Development Specialist with MyTax.
She's going far. She will be joining the Faculty of Mathematics as its Director of Innovation and Research Partnerships. In this role, she'll further the faculty's innovation agenda, there's that word again, by supporting entrepreneurial activities and facilitating meaningful collaborations between researchers and external partners. She will help raise the faculty's research profile, initiating and developing industry relationships, and helping to ensure more research funding. You can learn more about her new role on campus in the Daily Bulletin from July 29th. And I would like to remind folks that she was the interview guest talking about Concept by Velocity in episode 16.
That's right. And Concept will be celebrating its first anniversary this fall.
Woohoo!
Speaking of things that are coming up, with August just around the corner, so is move-in time for students planning to live in residence in the fall term. With thousands of students set to arrive on campus, Waterloo Residences has adjusted its procedures to ensure each student moves in safely.
Move-in is typically held over 3 days on Labor Day weekend, but this year's move-in will take place from August 24th to September 4th. Students moving in must sign up for a 60-minute time slot.
Oof, no pressure. Once students arrive on campus, they will need to answer some questions before receiving their keys. While they can bring as many people to campus as they need to help them move, only one person will be allowed to enter the residence building with each student. Masks and social distancing are required throughout the move.
You can learn more in the Daily Bulletin from Tuesday, July 28th. You're doing an awful lot of nodding to the Daily Bulletin there, Brando.
Well, we have to be self-referential, because if we don't reference ourselves, who will?
Exactly.
And once again, shout out to all the Daily Bulletin readers out there. I know you're out there. And now the interview. Summertime is the best time for stargazing in our area. And the Gustav Backhaus Observatory atop the physics building is normally busy with amateur astronomers wanting a good view of the night sky while learning about what's on the other end of the telescope. COVID-19 closed the observatory for now. But Victor Arora, who runs the facility, is taking things virtual. He has tips and resources you can use to stargaze at home.
Welcome back, Victor.
Thanks, Pamela.
So you lead the public tourism observatory, but the pandemic has closed it temporarily. It's a real drag because there have been some cool things happening in the night sky lately.
Yeah, there have. I think probably the most noteworthy thing, of course, is this wonderful comet that we've had visiting us this summer.
Yeah, Comet Neowise.
Yeah, and what a welcome surprise that was for those of us interested in what's happening up there.
But they don't call it a great comet. Why is that?
I don't know. I would call it a great comet. It looked pretty great to me. It was the first time I was able to ever see a comet with the unaided eye. I just went out to a park in my neighborhood, and it was there, you know, clear as clear as day. But it was just after sunset, and it was really kind of a beautiful scene. I knew it right away as soon as I saw it. I had a pair of binoculars with me as well, and it looked spectacular through the binoculars. Yeah, I would call it a great comet.
I think it had something to do with the fact that it was so close to the sun. There were concerns that the sun was going to break it up or something. I think it exceeded expectations.
It did. And you're actually right about that. When these comets come in from very, very far out in the kind of nether reaches of our solar system, and they come in on these paths that take them super close to the sun, and we never know what's going to happen. Are they even going to survive that? But it's actually the warmth of the sun that causes the ices on the nucleus of the comet to melt, and the little bits of rock that make up the center of these comets to peel off and make those beautiful tails that we see. So really, it's the fact that it got really close to the sun and still is relatively close that allows us to continue to see this comet gracing our skies.
So the comet first became visible to the naked eye in early July. Can we still see it?
Technically, you can still see it if you know exactly where to look. And there's lots of maps and things that you can find online if you just search for Comet Neowise or search for Comet Neowise map. You'll probably want to take a pair of binoculars with you as well. Maybe go to the darkest location that you can find. There's some things that are going against us, though. Kind of the longer you let this delay, the harder it'll be to see it, because the comet is now receding from the Earth and the sun. That's making it appear fainter in the sky. And we also have the moon, which is waxing in the sky. Basically, it's getting brighter and closer to the full phase, which will just reduce the amount of contrast that you have for seeing these faint things in the sky. So the best time to see it has gone. But if you hurry and you know where to look, you still probably have a chance of getting a peek at this thing.
Where are you supposed to look?
So if you look toward the northwest, you will see the constellation that I think everybody can identify, of course, the Big Dipper. And the Big Dipper is actually part of a bigger constellation called Ursa Major, or the Great Bear. And if you kind of look below the Dipper, to where, what we say, the paws of the Great Bear are, the comet has sort of been scurrying across the paws of the bear. And so if you kind of follow the handle of the Dipper, it sort of curves down toward where the bowl is, and then maybe a certain ways down, kind of halfway toward the horizon, you'll be able to find the comet. It's a bit difficult to describe in words where to look in the sky, and it does change from night to night. So again, looking for that map online, one good one that I can recommend is if you just go to timeanddate.com. This is that website that tells you when the sun rises and when the moon sets and all of these things, and they actually have a night sky feature that they've added recently. And it gives you a day-by-day interactive map showing you where to look to see this comet in the sky.
Hmm. Well, it was visible. I mean, when I tried to find it, it was under the Big Dipper, under the bowl of the Big Dipper.
That's
about
correct.
90 minutes after sunset, after it gets dark. But as the time goes on, it'll be rising in the sky, correct?
It'll get a little bit higher in the sky, and then it'll sort of eventually level out, and then start to fade as well as it goes back out into the cold depths of our solar system. So if you do want to see it, you do need to kind of head out sooner than later. One other suggestion I can give, if you're pretty sure that you're looking in the right spot in the sky, if you are looking through binoculars, if you just sort of avert your gaze, so you're trying to let the light go in through the corner of your eye, so to speak, it actually falls on a more sensitive part of your eye, and you're able to pick out some fainter things in the sky. It's a little bit of a stargazer's trick called averted vision. That can help to bring out these really, really faint things in the sky.
Wow, that's interesting. And I think it's really cool that you could actually see it with binoculars. People were seeing it with just binoculars. You don't have to have a telescope.
Yep, that's true. And it actually looked, I think I tried it with both binoculars and a small telescope. It actually, I think, looks better through binoculars. Through the telescope, you can't see too much of the tail. And it does really stretch a long way, or did stretch a long ways across the sky, larger than the field of view of my binoculars, in fact. So
if you miss it this time, you're going to have to wait 6,800 years to see it again. So you better get out there.
Yeah. And you know what? If you're really kind of marking your calendar for 6,800 years in the future, I did look that far ahead. And it's not going to be well placed 6,800 years from now either. It will be back in our neck of the woods, so to speak. But you might need to wait a little bit longer than that.
You actually looked. You can look 6,800 years in the future?
Yeah, you can. I mean, one of the things that astronomers do when they discover an object like this is they try to pin down its orbit or its path through the solar system as good as they can. And then once they know the path, they kind of know it for kind of long periods into the future, or they can know it for long periods in the future and predict when and where it will be visible. Certain things could change that, of course. The larger planets can give these comets a bump depending on exactly where they go.
Oh my goodness. So people are calling you. They want to come because all of this astronomy news, they want to come and look out the big telescope, but they can't. And so because they can't, how are you doing your outreach work and teaching people about astronomy?
We're thinking some sort of live stream or video conference event, but we wanted to do something that was more than just a talking head on a screen. We wanted to do something that was a little bit interactive. So we realized that the annual Perseids party wasn't happening this year for obvious reasons. So we decided that we could possibly do some sort of event on that evening. And so we have some demonstrations that we've planned for that evening, and maybe a little bit of guided sky watching, and just sort of segue into the meteor shower.
Right. So that's the Perseids meteor shower that happens every year in the summertime. Last time you were on the show, we talked about the Perseids and how to actually see it. And I remember you were saying you don't want to look at it through a telescope. You want to get a wide view of the night sky.
That's correct. And that's what everyone, you know, fingers crossed for the clear skies.
So what are you going to have for people for this event?
Well, I think the activity that we're going to do is I'm going to sort of help everybody make their ultimate interactive star map. This is something that goes by the name of a planisphere. And what this will show us is basically how the sky looks to us here in Waterloo at any time of year, at any time of the night. And it's kind of cool. You have this circle of paper that shows all the stars that you could possibly see in the sky, and you have this oval that goes on top of it that works as a kind of mask. And as I said, it's interactive. You turn this around and you're able to spin this circle and see exactly what the sky should look like at a given date, at a given time. And I think a really cool activity, especially for kids or for anyone who wants to learn about the night sky. You know, you don't need necessarily any technology to do that. You just need this cool little map that you're going to make, along with maybe a nice flashlight or something like that, and be able to see exactly what is up in the sky at any point in time you like. We're going to post a PDF online. You'll be able to download and print that.
Right.
They're really kind of cool. You can make one of that and you can keep it forever and basically use it forever as well.
You're going to be making that available online on the observatory's website?
Yeah. So people could definitely download this in advance and they could just sort of have it ready for that event, or they could make it along with us during that event. I'll be showing you all about how this works and why it works and how you can use it that particular night. If you've ever been to a meteor shower party, you know that a lot of the time is just spent waiting and looking up at the sky. And so it's a great opportunity to get to learn all the different constellations, the names of some of the brighter stars in the sky, and just basically get a good sense of our place in the universe.
Well, we are going to put a link to that fabulous star map, which I am also going to download. We're going to put a link to that in our show notes on SoundCloud so that everybody can access it and find it.
If I could, a shout out to the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. They're the ones that actually created the map and are providing it to us as well. They're a great organization. They do a lot for both the science of astronomy and for the public popularization of astronomy as well. There's a group in Waterloo that's very enthusiastic and has been very helpful with us in planning lots of events.
Now, what about other things that are happening in the summertime? Because summer is, as we mentioned, is the best time for stargazing because there tend to be fewer clouds.
Over the summer and going into the fall, for sure, we're actually going to have a little bit of a planet parade in the sky. If you look toward the southeast, you'll be able to see probably the brightest object in the sky. It looks like a very bright star. That's actually the planet Jupiter. And just to the left of it, a little bit further east, is the planet Saturn as well. And they're both going to be visible. They'll be rising a little bit earlier every day, but certainly through the end of the year, they will be visible in the sky. And if you're a bit of a night owl, if you wait until maybe midnight or so, you'll be able to see the planet Mars rising as well. And Mars is actually going to get brighter and brighter as the weeks pass until mid-October. It'll be about four times brighter than it is right now. And already, if you're up that late, you'll be able to see this really bright orangey-red beacon toward the east. And it's going to be pretty impressive, I think, by the time October rolls around. So the reason that Mars looks particularly, or will look particularly bright and will continue to get brighter, is because the sun is basically shining like a flashlight on Mars. It's 180 degrees away from it in the sky. What that means is that as the sun sets, Mars is going to appear to rise. Now, Mars is covered in a kind of soil, basically little bits of rock that all cast little shadows on the surface of Mars. And when we look at Mars, we can't see the little rocks, of course, but the little shadows combine with the reflected light that we see on Mars to give us an overall brightness or an overall sense of brightness on this planet. Now, if you imagine the light from the sun hitting at an oblique angle or from the side, then the shadows would be much longer, and we wouldn't get quite as much reflected light from Mars. Whereas when Mars is rising as the sun is setting, we have this case where the sun is shining directly on the planet and the shadows are very small and we're getting sort of the maximum amount of reflected light back toward the Earth. This is a time in Mars orbit known as opposition.
Okay, and what about Jupiter and Saturn?
We do see Jupiter and Saturn every year. For part of the year, they're too close to the sun in the sky. This part of the year, they're basically opposite the sun in the sky. So you could technically see them, I guess, during the day if you knew where to look and you're very careful to not point at your telescope too close to the sun, which is not something I recommend anyone tries to do, but certainly they're much easier to see now just by virtue of their position in the sky. And the position of really what's changing is where the Earth is in its orbit around the sun.
I was reading NASA recently released a photo taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, a photo of Saturn.
What a beautiful photograph, first of all. I just was taken aback by the amount of detail in this picture. So looking at the planet itself, seeing these wonderful bands all across this planet, basically totally enveloping it all the way around, just showing this amazing weather on this planet. I think this was taken during the summer, they call it the summer season on the planet Saturn. But the second thing that really kind of struck me as I saw it was just how bright the rings looked. I mean, they were, it looked like they were glowing. They were completely outshining the rest of the planet. And the reason that's happening is actually entirely due to geometry. It's all about where the Earth is and where the Sun is compared to Saturn.
Is it unusual to get such a good photo of Saturn?
Well, this was certainly among one of the best photos I've seen of Saturn, but the best times to take a photo of Saturn's rings actually happen every year by this phenomenon of opposition. So to understand that, you have to just take me at my word that Saturn's rings are actually made up of trillions of chunks of ice. Even though they look like they're solid to us from the Earth, there's actually, you know, uncountably many of these little ice-covered boulders all around the planet, completely encircling it, making up these rings that look solid to us because they're so far away. Now, even though they look like they're solid, again, because they're these individual boulders, these individual pebbles, these individual icebergs circling around this planet, that means that they cast shadows on the other boulders, the other chunks of ice that are around this planet. And so if the sun were shining on these boulders from the side, for example, they would cast shadows on other boulders, and the amount of light that we see reflected off of them from the Earth would be less. But it just so happens that right now, the Earth is roughly in between the sun and the planet Saturn. And so that means the sun is shining like a flashlight on Saturn, giving us the maximum amount of reflected light and making them look extremely bright. Another kind of cool factoid, the particles, the boulders, the chunks of ice that make up the rings of Saturn, they're actually almost pure ice to better than, you know, one part in 1,000 is like the contamination of the ice that's making up these ring particles, which is quite impressive. And you know, as Canadians, we all know that after a fresh snowfall, and if we have one of those rare sunny days, we go outside, we get that little bit of snow blindness, that water ice can be incredibly, incredibly reflective, probably the most reflective thing that you could think of in nature.
Yeah, I guess this is why NASA refers to Saturn as Lord of the Rings. No offense to the Tolkien fans out there.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly would agree with that.
And at this time of the photo, the planet was actually 839 million miles from Earth. I'm not going to do the metric conversion, but it's far enough. I also heard that you can actually see the International Space Station going over because friends of mine have photos of it. Tell me about that.
The best way to know when the space station is going to be visible in your neck of the woods is to sign up for alerts at the Space Station Watch website of NASA. You'll be able to put in your location and your email address. I think you can actually put in your mobile number as well if you like, and they'll send you notifications when it will be visible for you. They'll tell you where to look in the sky. They'll tell you how long it will be visible. And you can look really smart and tell all your friends that, hey, you see that thing up there in the sky that looks like the brightest star that's visible right now? That's actually not a star at all. That is the International Space Station orbiting overhead at, you know, 20,000 kilometers an hour, something like that.
Wow. Do you have to have a telescope to see that, though?
Absolutely not. It is as bright as pretty much any other star that you'll be able to see in the sky, probably brighter than that. And that's the reason that we can actually see it, is that it's reflecting light from the sun off of its solar panels. And it looks a little bit like an airplane without flashing lights. So it's just like a really bright star that very slowly, maybe over 5 or 6 minutes, crosses the entire sky. And you do not need a telescope. You do not need binoculars or anything special. You can see it with the unaided eyes.
I'm amazed at how much you can actually see in the night sky without any special equipment, expensive equipment.
Yeah, and it's a really great way to kind of get interested in astronomy. A lot of people think that when you want to go stargazing that you need to buy a telescope or something like that, but that's actually not true at all.
So the Perseids meteor shower event is going to be your first live stream event, but it's not going to be the only live stream event. Tell me a bit more about what's coming up.
Sure. So we just spend a little bit of time trying to think about other ways that we could engage people and give them a little bit of a distraction from, you know, just the difficult things that have been happening these days in the world. So we're thinking of possibly talking about telescopes, which is something we always do. But I bet that most people don't know that you can actually make a telescope at home, I think, with some material that you might already have. So we're planning to show people how to do that during one of our sessions. Once the university tentatively reopens a little bit and allows at least staff and faculty to return, we might be able to live stream an event from the rooftop of the physics building. We actually have a second telescope that I like to show people there. That's a robotic telescope that's used by our students. And we should, I think, be able to give people a taste for how that telescope works. And it's actually a pretty good simulation for how researchers do astronomy, the types of images that they get. And I think that would be a kind of a really cool window into a different side of astronomy. So that could be another live stream event that we do. And if I can convince maybe some of my colleagues to join me, or maybe some graduate students, we might do some Q&A, Ask the Astronomer type of events as well.
Oh, cool. No pressure. No pressure put on them right now here on the podcast.
Hint, hint.
What else do we need to know about stargazing from our homes in the summertime when we can't get to the Gustav Backus Observatory?
There's, you know, apps and things that you can download for your phone that will tell you where to look at certain things in the sky. There's computer programs and all sorts of other web resources that you can tap into. But I don't think anything really beats just having that map in your hands. It really kind of gives you an overview for what to see in the sky, or what you will see in the sky, and helps you understand really all the major changes that happen over the course of a year, because the way that the sky looks tonight is going to be slightly different than how it looks tomorrow, and will be quite different, you know, 6 months from now. And being able to understand that, I think, really kind of gives you a feeling for the fact that we're on this, you know, spinning top that's careening around this this star in our galaxy, and what we see night after night continually changes. I think anybody can learn the constellations probably in a couple of nights with no trouble at all.
Okay, I'll hold you to that. Well, Victor, your enthusiasm for astronomy is contagious as ever. I'll just let people know that the online Perseids event is taking place on August 11th. The rain date is August 12th. Yes, there are rain dates for online events when it comes to astronomy. You can find more information on the website for the Gustav Backus Observatory and in our show notes on SoundCloud. Victor, thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. The podcast is taking a break next week to recover from the August-long weekend. It's a great time to get caught up. You can find all of our past shows and links about the items we mentioned in today's show on soundcloud.com. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please subscribe to the Beyond the Bulletin podcast wherever you get your podcasts and recommend us to your colleagues.
Yes, please do. And please keep washing your hands often with soap and water and practice physical distancing of at least 2 meters.
And don't forget to mask up when headed indoors in public spaces.
If you'd like to provide feedback to us or give us an interview idea, please get in touch with us via email at bulletin@uwaterloo.ca.
Thanks for listening as we went beyond the bulletin. So, Pamela, did you attempt to see Comet Neowise?
I did try, and I couldn't see it.
Yeah, I tried to. I even had a pair of binoculars, but obviously not powerful enough to cut through the haze.
I had binoculars too, but I mean, you know, the binoculars are great, but they don't give you context, really. You're looking at something super close up, so I had no idea what I was looking at. I might have looked at it.
I tried using an app and kind of eyeballing where things are. Turns out astronomy is an exact science.